Hi, everyone. Welcome to the 12th episode of the Sfarim Chatter series on Shabbosites V. On this episode of this series, I spoke with Betzalel Naor, who wrote two books on the subject, one entitled Post-Sabbatian Sabbatianism, where he goes through various Sfarim and Mechabri Sfarim, where he talks about things that they said either that has Sabbatian origin or that has connections to it. And the other book is called Caught in the Crack, Encounters with the Jewish Muslims of Turkey, which is about the Dunme, and it's about interviews that he conducted with descendants of those. So we discuss this and various various things related to Sabbatianism. Once again, I would like to thank the corporate sponsor of the series, Gluck Plumbing, for all your service needs, big or small, in New Jersey, with a full service division. From boiler changeouts, main sewer line snakeouts, cammering main lines to a simple faucet leak, Gluck Plumbing Service Division has you covered. Give them a call, 732-523-1836, extension 1. 732-523-1836, extension 1. And as always, if anyone has any comments, questions, feedback, or would like to sponsor an episode, please email me, sfarimchatter@gmail.com. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Sfarim Chatter podcast and another episode in the Sfarim Chatter Shabbosites V series. On this episode of the podcast and the series, I'll be talking to Betzalel Naor, who is the author of two Sabbatian-related books, one called Post-Sabbatian Sabbatianism and the other one called Caught in the Crack, Encounters with the Jewish Muslims of Turkey, which he wrote under a pseudonym, Reuven Alpert, and that's about the Dunme. So thank you, Betzalel, for joining me.
Well, thank you, Nachi, for having me.
So let's start off. Tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background.
Okay. I was educated in both yeshivot and universities. So in that sense, I'm kind of an amalgam of two worlds. And most people know me for my research of Rav Kook. However, I have this other line of research that I've pursued over the years, which is Sabbatianism. And as you said, I came out with two books, Post-Sabbatian Sabbatianism, which is more academic. By the way, it has a beautiful endorsement by Moshe Idel. Can I read his blurb? Naor studies illumine the great variety of spiritual developments generated by Shabtai Tzvi's messianic claims and Nathan of Gaza's theology. These studies of the reverberations and the reception of Sabbatianism in hitherto neglected sources are a major contribution to the understanding of Judaism in the aftermath of Shabtai Tzvi's death. And as your listeners know, Moshe Del is one of the greatest authorities alive today on Kabbalah. So I was very happy to receive that encomium. The other book, Caught in the Crack, pivots on interviews that I conducted in Greece and Turkey with Dunme, which is not the best way to refer to such people. It's actually a Turkish pejorative term. They themselves would refer to themselves as ma'aminim, as opposed to the rest of us who rejected Shabtai Tzvi, who were the minim. Okay, if you can wrap your mind around that. Orthodox Jews who reject Shabtai Tzvi have never construed themselves as minim, but that's how the Sabbatians refer to us. They're the maminim, they're the believers, and we are the minim, the heretics. So they're two very different books. They have different flavors. Post-Sabbatian Sabbatianism is more academic, textual, theoretical. The other book moves around. It moves around the Balkans. And these are very colorful characters that I had the privilege of interviewing. So that's what I have to say in general about the two books.
Now, let me ask you. So, like you mentioned, your expertise or what you're known for is your work with Orot and as you founded and your work on Rav Kook. But you obviously have these two books on Sabbateanism. So how did you become interested in Sabbateanism? When did that happen?
It's a great question. I'll tell you the honest truth. For the first 40 years of my life, I really was very turned off by the topic. I found it very distasteful. There was a lot of material out there, a lot of books which were very popular. The Bible of Sabbatean Studies is this 1,000-page work by Gershom Scholem, Sabbatai Savi, The Mystical Messiah, was published by Princeton University. It's part of the Bollingen series. And all of this stuff was coming out, and I stayed away from it with a 10-foot pole. I found the whole topic very distasteful. And then something happened in 1994. In Chabad, it's referred to as Gimel Tammuz. Anyone who was living in New York in those days, in the early 90s, was caught up in these events surrounding Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, Zichrono Livracha, of blessed memory. And then, as I said, there was this event of Gimel Tammuz, the Histalkut, the passing of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And that got me started on Sabbatean studies. Now, the Rebbe himself had asked his Hasidim to study the Rambam, Hilchot Mlachim. You know, at the end of Rambam's Mishneh Torah, at the end of Hilchot Mlachim, there are two chapters about Mashiach, and the Rebbe had told the Lubavitcher Hasidim that they should study this in preparation for Mashiach, and especially during the 3 weeks, Bein HaMetzarim, between Shivasar B'Tammuz and Tisha B'Av. I may have studied that too, but what the Rebbe indirectly prompted me to study was Sabbateanism, because I said I need to find out how Jews in the past have come to terms with an acute messianism that has resulted in some kind of debacle. How did they come to terms with this? And I studied it theoretically. I read hundreds of articles and books. And eventually, I took a flight. I took a couple of flights to Greece and to Turkey to interview the remnants of the believers of Shabtai Tzvi, the Maminim, or in Turkish referred to as Dönme, which means turncoats, and it can even mean cross-dressers, and it's a horrible term, okay? So that's how I got started. There's something else I want to share. And this is a dream that I had back when I was living in Kiryat Arba, Hebron. And I recorded this dream in another book I wrote, also under that same pseudonym of Reuven Alpert. It's called God's Middleman. And it was a very impactful dream, a very powerful dream. And I'll share it with your listeners. I dreamt that I had a yechidus with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, something that I did not have in waking life, although we exchanged letters, but I never had yechidus. And in this dream, I'm having yechidus with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he takes me on a tour de force of Jewish history, and he shows me how in each generation there was one individual who had the potential to be the Mashiach. And I saw many different figures, as you can imagine. It was a long dream, you know, because as I said, he took me through the Seder Hadorot, and there was one that I remembered upon waking. This fellow was an obscure figure. He lived back in the 1800s, and he was a son of the great Rishon Rebbe, Rabbi Yisrael Friedman of Rishon. And his name was Dov Ber of Liova. He was named after the great Magid, Rabbi Dov Ber of Mizrich, the ancestor of the Rishon. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe showed me in the dream that this fellow, Dov Ber of Liova, was the candidate in his generation. He was the one who was slated, who had the potential to be the Mashiach. I woke up and I laughed my head off. I said, this is nuts. This is the craziest dream. This Dov Ber of Liova was a very small, insignificant figure in Jewish history. How could he have possibly been the Mashiach in potentia? Now, that was a dream back in the early 80s. Fast forward about a decade to 1994. After Gimel Tammuz, I went to the library, Gottesman Library. I had a card, we'll call it. I'd actually been faculty there for a while. So I had library privileges, and I loaded up a whole, I don't know how to describe it, a bin full of books on Sabbatianism. And I took them with me to a vacation home in Maine, by the side of a lake in Maine. And I hunkered down and I started to read all of these books on Sabbatianism. And it was about 2 a.m. in the wee hours of the morning. And I'm lying in bed reading one of these books. And lo and behold, I come across a passage. It was in a book by the historian Shmuel Versus, as I recall, where he says that the Hasidim, the Rishon Hasidim, believed that Dov Ber of Liova was the Mashiach. And unfortunately, he had a great nefilah or mapalah. He was converted to Haskalah. And there's a whole literature on Dov Ber of Liova. There's literature written by Hasidim and by professors, and by now there are probably even plays dramatizing what happened to him. So the dream was a true dream.
So I was like, oh, what I say to that? That's a very interesting dream. And so you have this.
We have to come back to waking life, right?
Yeah, that's where I was going to go. So you have this dream, like I said, you're reading these books after the Lubavitcher Rebbe dies. So from there, how did you get to, okay, I'm not only going to look into this and read about this, I'm going to write these two books. I'm going to actually research it enough to write two books about the top topic.
All right. As we said, I'm most known as a authority on Rav Kook, Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, who was the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael. It wasn't called Medinat Yisrael in those days. It was a British mandate called Palestine. But it was called Eretz Yisrael. And he was the Rav HaRashi, the Ashkenazic chief rabbi. There was a Sephardic counterpart, Yaakov Meir, who was the Rishon LeZion, which was an older office. The Sephardim had that office of Rishon LeZion under the Ottomans, the Chacham Bashi. The idea that there would be an Ashkenazic chief rabbi was a British invention. So let me speak a little about this nexus of Rav Kook and Sabbateanism. And usually we put Rav Kook together with Zionism, for better or for worse. But today, we're going to put Rav Kook vis-a-vis Sabbateanism, and we'll see what comes of it. Yeah, all right. So we're going to talk about Rav Kook vis-a-vis Sabbateanism. First of all, before we do that, this Purim will be the 40th yahrzeit of Rav Tzvi Yehuda HaKohen Kook, who was the Ben Yochid. He was the only son of the chief rabbi of Rav Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, and he was my teacher. I was never formally enrolled in his yeshiva Merkaz HaRav, but I had the zchut, the great merit and privilege to have many one-on-one sessions with Tzvi Yehuda HaKohen Kook. And he passed away Purim, the Prazot, Tavshin Membet. And so this Purim, Tavshin Peibet, is exactly, it's 40 years. And Chazal tell us, Lokoi Yinush Adaitid Rabbei Ad Arba'in Shnin, that it takes the Talmud 40 years to really understand what his Rebbe was talking about. So hopefully, come Purim this year, I should be zochet to be Omed Al Dat Rabbi. But one very important teaching of Rav Tzvi Yehuda HaKohen Kook, which again he told to me in private conversation, we had many wonderful private conversations, was klaliut. Don't get bogged down in pratim. It happens many times to researchers that they can't see the forest for the trees, if you know what I'm saying. They get bogged down in the nitpicking details. It happens to many wonderful scholars, and they lose sight of the overall picture, the broader issues at stake. And this was a very important teaching of Rav Tzvi Yehuda, transmitted to me. It came to him from his father, Avram Yitzchak, klaliut. So, as I told you in private conversation, Nachi, my degrees are in philosophy. I have a BA in philosophy. I have an MA in Jewish philosophy. And while the book, or both of the books, do enter into pratim, but hopefully what I'm trying to, I try, I don't know whether I succeed, what I try to convey in the books is this, is klaliut, the overall picture, and why we Jews should be interested at all in the history of Shabtai Tzvi and his prophet Nathan of Gaza. These are events that happened way back in the 1600s. And of what relevance is it to Jews living today in the 21st century? So, for starters, There's a passage in Orot. I don't know if you've looked at this. This is Rav Kook's seminal work, Orot. It was published in Yerushalayim in 1920. And I had the schut, the great merit, to translate it into English, introduce it, translate it, annotate it. And let me read to you a very short passage from Orot, which has direct bearing on our discussion. This is almost to the very end of Orot. It's in the section Orot HaTchiya. It's Perek Ayin. That's chapter 70. And I gave it an English caption, Fallen Giants and the Flames of Inner Torah. Great masters affect the return of the fallen souls of Israel, not through externals, but by putting people in touch with the Inner Torah. In this way, the fallen messianic potential of the national revivalist movement will be repaired. So that's my header, but let me read you Rav Kook's own words. He speaks about Gedolei HaNeshama, great souls, HaMakirim et Halichot Dofek HaChayim Shel Klalut HaUma Kula, who have their finger on the pulse of the entire Jewish people. The Heim Heim Balei HaYesod HaElyonim. In another version says, the Heim Heim Balei HaSod HaElyonim. These would be Kabbalists. Asher Ya'alu et Kol HaYeridot, who will be able to uplift all of the descents, Ben Shelahem, Ben Shel Klal Yisrael, whether their own descents, or the descents of Klal Yisrael. And here's the crucial phrase now. Ben shel kol hanefilim, asher amdu liyot mishichim, v'naflu v'nokshu v'nishberu, hinei nitpazru nitzotzehem umvakshim tikun chai v'kayam, v'yisod David melech Yisrael, ruach apenu Mashiach Hashem. Let me read you my English translation. They are the exalted masters of the foundation who will raise up all the descents, whether their own, those of the Jewish people, or those of the fallen giants who stood to be messiahs but fell, were trapped and broken. Their sparks were scattered and seek a living and enduring correction in the foundation of David. And I quoted this passage in post-Sabbatian Sabbatianism. There is a chapter here, which I know you read. It's entitled Rav Kook on Sabbatianism, chapter 14. And there I quoted a different version. Before Orot, there was a previous work of Rav Kook, which was suppressed. And it was called Arpile Tohar. It was at the printer in 1914, and then it disappeared from view. It was suppressed. And in this earlier work, instead of Nephilim, it says Nephilim, fetuses. And so you're getting a little different English translation in post-Sabbatianism. The fetuses who stood to be messiahs, but fell, were trapped and broken. Their sparks were scattered and seek a living, enduring correction, tikkun, in the foundation of David, king of Israel, the breath of our nostrils, the anointed of God. So I think it's transparent to anybody who is a bar dat, a bar seichel. Rav Kook is alluding to fallen messiahs. He doesn't spell them out by name. I would assume one of them is definitely Shabtai Tzvi. And what happened to these neshamot, these great souls, Nephilim are fallen giants, Nephilim are aborted fetuses. It's based on the Aramaic, Bar Nifle, and Perek Chelek, you have the Aramaic term Bar Nifle, and the Vilna Gaon in his commentary to the Tikkunim, Tikkunei Zohar, explains the term Bar Nifle, that just as sometimes there's a pregnancy that doesn't make it to full term, and the fetus is spontaneously aborted in, I don't know, the seventh or eighth month. So the Vilna Gaon says that there were Bar Nifle, there were neshamot that had the potential to be the Mashiach of their generation, and it didn't come to fruition. So they're Nephilim, they're fetuses that didn't make it full term. They were preemies. And but in the other version, the later version, it's changed from Nephilim to Nephilim, who were Anakim, fallen giants. But anyway, the question is, what happened to the neshamot of these people? What happened to their nitzotzot, to use the Kabbalistic term, the sparks? And Rav Kook is following a tradition. You see it in the history of Hasidut. The Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, the Besht, Shivchei HaBesht, it's recorded there that he tried to do Tikkun HaNeshama of Shabtai Tzvi. He tried to uplift Shabtai Tzvi's soul, and he was not able to. You know, you had this authority on the history of Frankism, but in his talk, I didn't hear mention of what's written Likutei Moharan concerning the Frankists. Rabbi Nachman Breslov, Rabbi Nachman Breslov was a great grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, and Likutei Moharan, it's recorded that the Baal Shem Tov died of two holes in his heart that resulted from the loss of this segment of our people. He felt that the Frankists, I can't go into the whole history of Frankism, and I'm not an authority. That's a century later. Shabtai Tzvi, his debak, his conversion to Islam, takes place in 1666. So a century later, in Poland, you have Jacob Frank and his followers who eventually were converted to Catholicism. And before that, there was a vikuach. There were actually two vikuchim. And the Baal Shem Tov felt that the rabbis didn't deal with this problem properly. He felt as long as that limb is still attached to the body of the Jewish people, there's hope for them. But once it's cut off, it's over. And Reb Nachman, his great-grandson, says that he died of two holes in his heart that resulted from the conversion of the Frankists to Catholicism, which for the Baal Shem Tov was a major tragedy when we lose Jews. So people like the Baal Shem Tov and his great-grandson, Reb Nachman, they were very busy with tikkunei neshamot, fixing souls. Rav Kook is famous for his outreach. You know, before we had Jewish outreach organizations, we had a one-man Jewish outreach organization. It was called Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kook. And from the time that he arrived in Eretz Yisrael in 1904, right before Shavuot 1904, until his passing, Gimel Elul, 1935, he was constantly going out to the irreligious and anti-religious Jews who were very far from Jewish tradition, Jews who were disaffected, turned off. They might have studied in yeshivas, but they were very turned off and very bitter and scornful and hateful towards the rabbinic establishment. Some of them were chalutzim, living in kibbutzim, and others lived in Yafo. And Rav Kook was famous for this, for trying to reach out to brothers and sisters who were very far away from Yiddishkeit. So he was famous for that kind of tikkuni neshamot, but something that most people do not realize and may have difficulty relating to because it's a very Kabbalistic notion. Rav Kook was doing tikkuni neshamot not only of the people alive in his generation, but he, through Kabbalistic practices, was doing tikkuni neshamot of souls that had passed away in the past, in the distant past, centuries before. Again, to go to Reb Nachman, why is Reb Nachman buried in Uman? His whole life, he didn't live in Uman. He's not called Reb Nachman Umaner, he's called Reb Nachman Breslover. Obviously, he didn't live in Uman his whole life. He came there the last months of his life, before the end. He knew he was dying of TB. And he wanted to be buried in Uman, because in that cemetery in Uman, by the way, Ukraine is in the news as we speak, and we'll see what will be the future of Uman in days to come. Reb Nachman explained to his Hasidim that the reason he has to be buried in Uman is because in that cemetery, there are tens of thousands of Jews lying buried. He had to uplift those souls. So, as I said, the Baal Shem Tov wanted to uplift the neshama of Shabtai Tzvi, and Reb Nachman was doing tikkuni neshamot of souls from bygone eras, and Rav Kook was another such mekubal. Never forget, Rav Kook is a Kabbalist. He's a mystic. And he's trying to uplift the neshama of Spinoza. And there are books being written about that now, about Rav Kook vis-a-vis Spinoza. And this was not theoretical. We have a edut of his Talmud, Rav Yaakov Moshe Chalav, who was a Talmid Chaver of Rav Kook. He was, Rav Kook said that when he and Rav Chalap are in the room, there aren't two people there. There's only one person. That's how close they were. And Rav Chalap revealed to his Talmud, Rav Yosef Leib Zussman, that when Rav Kook and Rav Chalap would do these tikkuni neshamot, they would actually see the neshama in the room with them. So it wasn't academic, it wasn't theoretical. This was a Kabbalistic exercise. I can't say in the flesh, in the ghost. So that's what he's alluding to in that passage in Orot, that all of these Nephilim, these I won't call them false messiahs. I'll call them failed messiahs or fallen messiahs. Rav Kook calls them Nephilim or Nephilim bar Nifle. There has to be a tikkun neshama. And now I'm going to reveal to you a chidush that came to me yesterday, Shabbat. Do you know the date when Shabtai Tzvi converted to Islam? Maybe we should tell the listeners how that figures in the story. Shabtai Tzvi is born, was it 1626? You know this better than I do by now. You've been doing so many of these sessions.
1626, I think, yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't live very long. He lives 50 years until 1676. The big year that we have to keep in mind is 1666. That's the crescendo of his messianic movement. And unfortunately, that same year, it didn't last very long. Within months, that same year, he was forcibly converted to Islam. And after he was Islamized, he lived another 10 years in Adrianople, a place that I visited. If you read my book, Caught in the Crack, you'll see that. It was preceded by another amazing dream. Yeah, because I was in Greece and I was going to cross over the border to Turkey, Adrianople, or today in Turkish, Edirne is right on the Turkish border with Greece. And I knew I wanted to get to Edirne. I didn't know anything about it. And it was a very hazardous border crossing. If you read my book, at that time, relations between Greece and Turkey were very hostile. And I stayed in a hotel on the Greek side. I remember it was winter, it was freezing. And I dreamt this magnificent synagogue. And again, the next morning, I woke up laughing my head off because I'm thinking this is totally ridiculous. Probably I'll cross over to this Turkish city of Edirne and I won't find anything. And here I'm seeing in my dream this most magnificent synagogue. Well, I crossed to Turkey. I got to Edirne and lo and behold, I saw that magnificent synagogue, one of the most magnificent synagogues in Europe. It was patterned after the synagogue in Vienna. And when I entered it, it was a churva, mamash. I was lucky it didn't fall down on me. There were no Jews living in the city. They had left long before. I visited the city and the cemetery. I did not meet one living Jew. And the Turkish... Misrad Tayarut, the Bureau of Tourism, they asked me, maybe you want to go back to America and collect funds and we'll rebuild this magnificent synagogue, which is on the verge of collapse. And some years ago, it was rebuilt. Again, there's not a living Jewish community there, but it's of such historic importance that that synagogue was rebuilt. Anyway, the last 10 years of Shabtai Tzvi's life were spent in Edirne or Adrianople. And from there, he was banished to Albania. Albania, to the Ottoman Empire, was what Siberia was to the Russian Empire, okay? It's a place where you were banished to. Like the Russians would banish you to Siberia. So the Ottoman Turks would banish you to Albania. And there's a question where Shabtai Tzvi is exactly in Albania. We won't go into that. But the Dvar Chidush I want to share with you is, I'm going to ask you a question now, Nachi. What was the exact date that Shabtai Tzvi was converted to Islam? This was in the presence of the Sultan, the Padishah, of the entire Ottoman Empire, who was holding court in Adrianople, and Shabtai Tzvi is brought in to him, and he's given a choice. Either you convert to Islam or off with your head. And he chose to convert to Islam. But what was the date?
I don't, off the top of my head, I don't have it. Was it in September? Also, I don't know where the Hebrew month was. You probably have the answer.
Okay. It was Ted Zayin Elul. Okay. All right. This you're going to guess. What is Rav Cook's birthday?
based on how you're asking it, it's probably Hezael.
All right. Everybody knows that Rav Kook passed away on Gimel Elul. Very few people are aware that he was born on Tetzayin Elul, okay? By the same token, very few people are aware that Shabtai Tzvi was converted to Islam on Tetzayin Elul. If you read Shalom's books, he's using the secular dates of September, and I see you're well read. You knew September. So based on what I was seeing in Shalom, I figured it would correspond to Tetzayin Elul, but I had to wait until Shabbos was over last night to Google and Wikipedia, and sure enough, it was Tetzayin Elul. Now, you know, we Jews, we believe in Hashgacha Pratit. That's a very firm belief in Judaism. There aren't coincidences. Nothing is random. That's what Amalek subscribed to. This is Chodesh Adar, Adar Rishon. So we're battling Amalek and Asher Korcha Baderech. So Amalek subscribed to the notion that everything is Mikre, that things happen by chance, random events, happenstance. But we choose a firm believers in Hashgacha Pratit. So what do I derive from the fact that Tetzayin Elul in 1666, Shabtai Tzvi is converted to Islam, and 200 years later, Tetzayin Elul, 1865, Rav Kook, neshama, comes down into this world. You know what? But before we put those two together, I want to share with you a story that was told to me by Ilgaz Zerler. That name wouldn't register with you. He's one of the interviewees in Caught in the Crack. We did not meet in person. The interview was conducted the way you're interviewing me now. I was in my hotel room in Istanbul, and we had a long telephone conversation. Who is Ilgaz Zerler? Ilgaz Zerler is a grandson of Shemsi Effendi. Who's Shemsi Effendi? Shemsi Effendi is the Hoja, the teacher of Ataturk. Ataturk you heard of. Ataturk, the founder of the modern Republic of Turkey. At the end of World War I, the Ottoman Empire fell apart. And let me just grab a drink of water. In the 1920s, Ataturk founded the modern Republic of Turkey. Ataturk, as a boy, studied in Saloniki or Salonika. At that time, it was part of the Ottoman Empire. And Saloniki, or today in Greece, it's called Thessaloniki, was the, what should we call it? It was the Yerushalayim of the Derneme. That was their center. And in Salonika, you had Muslims on the one hand and had Jews on the other hand, and caught between them, you had the Maminim. And it was a sizable population. And they were significant not only numerically, but also politically and otherwise. And they had schools, they had very good schools. They were forward-thinking, they were modernists, they were very fond of French civilization, and their schools were French-speaking. And Ataturk, who was not Derneme, to the best of our knowledge, His mother was a more devout Muslim. His father was a modernist, and he wanted his son to receive a great secular education, and he enrolled him in one of the three schools of the Dernmeh. And his teacher there was a fellow by the name of Shemsi Efendi, who's buried in Istanbul, and he was a Dernmeh. And I interviewed in Istanbul his grandson. His name is Ilgaz Erler. And Ilgaz revealed to me a Dernmeh tradition concerning the Islamization of Shabtai Tzvi, his forcible conversion. And before I tell you the actual story, I just want to give a brief psychological preface. When a Jew who was presumed to be Mashiach fails in his mission, or does not come full term, is a nefel, a preemie, how do his believers deal with that? As well, you can appreciate it creates what psychologists call cognitive dissonance. It's very tough to come to terms with that. You believe in a man that you believe that that a certain individual is Mashiach, and the next thing you know, oops, he's a Muslim. He's converted to a different faith community altogether. How do you deal with that? And there's a tradition in one of the Dernmeh communities. They're divided in three. There's the Jacoblar and the Kapanjilar and the Karakashlar. Lar is the plural form in Turkish. So Yakubis Kapanjis and Karakash. Anyway, one of the three communities preserved this tradition that Shabtai Tzvi, when he emerged from the Sultan's palace, opened up his great coat and a bird flew out from his breast. And that was his neshama leaving him. When I heard this story over the phone, I was so moved, I burst into tears. So to come back to Tet Zayin Elul, you have this neshama of Shabtai Tzvi that leaves and, you know, figuratively, as a bird, it just flies out from his breast and Tet Zayin Elul. Where does the neshama go? So 200 years later, Tet Zayin Elul, there's a neshama that comes into this world, Avram Yitzchak, a Kohen Cook, that sets as its express goal, its mission in life, its shlichut, to do Tikkun HaNeshama, for this Neshama of Shabtai Tzvi, and for many other Neshamot, whether it's Oto Ha'ish, whether it's Spinoza, whether it's the Neshama Kolelet of Zionism. So the book, Post-Sabane Sabanianism, to come back to Lamata Me'asot Tvachim, as its name indicates, it deals with the movement after the death of Shabtai Tzvi. And that was in 1676, somewhere in, he dies on Yom Kippur. He's born, of course, on Tisha B'Av, Shabtai Tzvi, according to the tradition, and he dies on Yom Kippur, which is a very fitting day. Reza Baal Teshuvah and Yom Kippur. His Navi Natan Ha'azati, Nathan of Gaza, survives him by 4 years. He passes away in 1680. We know exactly where he was buried, in Skopje, or Iskopje, Macedonia, Firom, F-Y-R-O-M, former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. At least that's the way the Greeks refer to it. There's a lot of politics there. And yeah, because the Greeks resent that they call themselves Macedonians. All right, I can't go into that whole schism. Anyway, there's a lot of geopolitics. But before he dies, Nathan has Talmidim. He has a very profound Kabbalistic teaching, Nathan of Gaza. He and his believers saw him as the Gilgul of the Ari. The Ari had made, that's Rabbi Yitzchak Luria in Sfat, passes away in the 1500s. I think it was Shin Lamed Bet, if I'm not mistaken. That would be 1572 in Sfat. And the Ari makes an elliptical statement before he dies that, if you're Zocheh, I'll come back again and complete the teaching. And Nathan of Gaza saw himself in this role as Rabbi Isaac Luria Redux. There's no doubt that he's a world-class Kabbalist. So without exaggeration, I'm not a Baki b'Torah Gilgulim. I cannot tell you whether Nathan of Gaza is a reincarnation of the Ari. But what I can tell you as a student of Kabbalah is that his works of Kabbalah, the magnum opus of Sefer Bria, which was recently published by Lior Holzer of Holzer Sfarim in Jerusalem, and the other work, Zmir Aritzim, are major works of Kabbalah. So again, you know, whether he is truly a Gilgul of the Ari, you know, I'm not an expert on Gilgulim, but there's no doubt that he is a world-class Kabbalist, and he has Talmidim. And his teaching is preserved through the Talmidim and Talmidehem, and they spread throughout Europe. He had a midrash in Salonika those last years. And the Talmidim spread out. The teaching spread out. They go as far as Amsterdam. One of the fellows that I deal with in post-Sabbeinism is the Sephardic chief rabbi of Amsterdam. His name is Solomon Aileon, Chacham Shlomo Aileon, was someone who imbibed the Kabbalah of Nathan, and he himself wrote Kabbalistic treatises. So this is somebody who's very high placed in the rabbinic establishment, as well you can imagine. He's a Sephardic chief rabbi of Amsterdam, and he was powerful enough at one point to run out of town two men. One is named Chacham Tzvi. That's how we refer to him. Reb Tzvi Ashkenazi, the father of Rav Yaakov Emden. And the other one was Reb Moshe Chajiz. And you can read about that in Elisheva Kalbach's book, Pursuit of Heresy, which is a study of Rabbi Moshe Chajiz. But who are some other very important disciples of Nathan? And they may not be direct disciples, Talmidim. They may be Talmidim of Talmidim, disciples, disciples. In Italy, you have Rabach. Who's Rabach? Rabach, that's Rabbi Binyamin Cohen. He is the father-in-law of Rabbi Yeshaya Bassan, or Bassani. Who's Rabbi Yeshaya Bassani? He's the Rebbe of Ramchal. Everybody knows Ramchal. Every yeshiva boy, whoever has studied Mesivat Yesharim, knows Ramoshe Chaim Lutzato. Well, Lutzato, unbeknown to the Bachurei Yeshiva, is someone who studied the writings of Nathan of Gaza. He studied the Kabbalah of Natan Azati, Sefer HaBriah. So, in Germany, Yaakov Emden and Moshe Chajiz suspect Ramchal of being a Sabbatian. Ramchal was not a Sabbatian. He was not one of the Maminim, but he was a Talmud of a son-in-law of a very devout Maamin. And, you know, Rabbi Yaakov Emden is the Joe McCarthy of Jewish history. You've heard of McCarthy, but in McCarthy era, that's the early 1950s in this country. The saying attributed to Senator Joseph McCarthy is, there's a communist under every bed. So I think for Rav Yaakov Emden, we could say the same thing. There was a Sabbatian under every bed. But you know what? If you accuse enough Sabbatians, eventually you'll come up with the real thing, right? Just like Joe McCarthy accused so many people that eventually he did uncover some genuine communists, some Reds. So Rav Yaakov Emden accused so many people of being crypto-Sabbatians, or post-Sabbatian, that some of them actually were. In this case, he was right and he was wrong when it came to Ramchal, Ramosh Chaim Lutzato. And one of the chapters in the book is about Rabach. We'll come to Rabach in a second. Moshe Chaim Lutzato lived in Padua. The rabbi there was Yeshaya Bassani. It was a halachis. We have Shelot to Tshuvot of Rabbi Yeshaya Bassani. And his father-in-law, this Rabach, as he was called, Rabbi Binyamin Cohen, was a great Kabbalist. And he believed in Shabtai Tzvi. He was a totally... I don't know what to call him, Orthodox Jew, upgehidden, Shomer Torah Mitzvot, who believed that Shabtai Tzvi was the Messiah. After all was said and done, after Shabtai Tzvi was forcibly converted to Islam, you see, this is the great mistake a lot of people make. They think after 1666, after Tetzai and Elul, that's it. The entire Jewish people washed their hands of Shabtai Tzvi. It wasn't that way at all. Most did. But there were a remnant of Maminim who clung to him. And it went on and on and on. And you had Pavel here talking about the Frankists. And he said, we don't know how long it went on for. You know, what's the terminus ad quem of this whole Frankist movement. So, but it went on for centuries, you know, it went on into the 1700s. And in the case of the Frankists, it went on into the early 1800s in Prague. So let's talk about some of these rabbis who are, you know, totally observant. They observe a very strict halacha Judaism, but unbeknown to the masses, they persist. They cling to this belief in Shabtai Tzvi, and they have their own Kabbalah, which comes out of Nathan. So we mentioned Solomon Eilion, in the rabbi of Amsterdam. We've talked a little about what was going on in Italy. As I said, Ramchal's Rebbe was Yishai Basani, who was a son-in-law of Rabach. And from Rabbi Yishai Basani, Ramchal was able to procure the writings, the Kabbalistic writings, these manuscripts of Nathan of Gaza. And he writes a letter to his Rebbe, to Rabbi Yishai Basani, that he did with Natan Azati what Rabbi Meir did with Acher. You know, there's a story in the second parak of Chagigah, parak Ein Dorshim, that the great Rabbi Meir had a Rebbe, Elisha ben Avuya, we call him Acher, who was a heretic. And the question arises, how could Rabbi Meir study from such a man? You know, we're told that your Rebbe has to be domeh l'malach Hashem Tzvakot. You know, if your Rebbe is like an angel of the Lord of hosts, Torah yibakshu mipiu, then you can study Torah from him. But if he's not on that level of a malach Hashem, so you're not allowed to study. So how did Rabbi Meir study Torah from Ach? So Meir, the answer is Rimon Matzah. He found a pomegranate. Klipato zerak tocho achal. He threw away the rind and he ate the inside, the delicious fruit inside. So Ramchal writes that that's what he did with the writings of Nathan of Gaza, that he did like Reb Meir did with Acher, that he threw away the klipa, all the stuff about Shabtai Tzvi. But the good stuff that is sound Kabbalistic teaching that he imbibed. So that was Ramchal. And as I said, he was suspected by Emden and Chajiz of being an outright Sabbain. He was not. But his Rebbe's father-in-law was Rabach, Rabbi Benjamin Cohen. He, together with Avraham Rovigo, they were the two great Sabbatian Kabbalists in Italy. This is in the beginning of the 18th century, of the 1700s. Now we're going to go over to Izmir, Turkey. We're going to head east. We're heading east, right? We started in Amsterdam at the west, and then we went to Italy. Now we're going further east. We're going to go to Izmir. In 1731, there's published in Izmir an amazing sefer, Chemdat Yamim, which you can buy in Sfarim stores, Chemdat Yamim. Rav Moshe Tzuriel reissued it. And the editor was Al-Ghazi. Again, people in the yeshiva world study Maharit Al-Ghazi. If you're sitting, you're learning in Kollel, you're an Avrech, Jungelite, you're studying Bechorot. And in the back of the Masicht is the Ramban. And on Ramban, there's this amazing commentary of Maharit Al-Ghazi. But Maharit Al-Ghazi's father, Rabbi Yisrael Yaakov Al-Ghazi, who lived in Izmir, in 1731 publishes a work, Chemdat Yamim. And it's a very controversial work to this day. I just read something somebody sent me by Yechiel Goldhaber. Scholars continue to be machadish chidushim in Chemdat Yamim, finding this, that, and the other. For many, many years, it was a mystery who wrote it. Emden believed that it was the work of Nathan of Gaza. Why did Rabbi Yaakov Emden believe this? The Joe McCarthy of Judaism, for a very simple reason. Embedded in Chemdat Yamim are three Zmirot signed by Nathan of Gaza. The way the Ari wrote Zmirot for Shabbat, so Nathan of Gaza wrote three of them. I studied one of them. In the back of Kosebein Sabbatianism, you're reading it, I guess, left to right, which is English, but if you read right to left, so in Hebrew, this is Shir Lelel Shvi'i Shel Pesach, Siman Ani Avraham Natan Binyamin Ben Elisha Chaim Chazak. Well, There's no better proof than that than Nathan Gaza wrote it. He signed it. That's him. Ani Avraham Natan Binyamin Ben Elisha Chaim. He signed it. And there are two others like this. As I said, this is the one that I have annotated by referring to all the other works of Nathan. In order to understand the Zemer, the poem, you have to study all of the other works of Nathan to understand what he has encapsulated in this poem. And there are two others. So Rav Yaakov Emden jumped to the conclusion that Nathan of Gaza wrote the whole book. If it contains three poems of this Nathan of Gaza, Mistavcha, that he wrote the whole book, but that was wrong. So who wrote it? And this was a ta'aluma, this was a mystery for years and years and years. And all kinds of theories were proffered, all kinds of conjectures, and some are wilder than others. But Professor Yeshayahu Tishbe clinched it. It's the fellow who posed as the editor was also the author. His name is Elgazi. Yisrael Yaakov Elgazi. This sometimes happens, that a fellow poses as the editor, and he's more than the editor. He's the author. And what Goldhaber is doing, Hilgal, is bringing more highest internal proofs based on very careful, meticulous textual analysis that in Achinami, that it was Elgazi. This is one of the very few works, I guess we could say it's the only work of Sabadianism to mainstream. The others were weeded out. The Chabonim would catch on that the work smacked of Sabadianism, and that would be the end of it. It would be either end up burnt or ganuz. That would be a halachic question, what to do with it at that point. Do you burn it as a Sefer Torah Shiktavo Min? Or maybe you don't have to burn it, you just Ligniza, and Ramchal opines on that. But it would be disappeared. And it would... It would be lost. And this one book, incredibly, despite Rabbi Yaakov Emden's outing it, survived. It managed to mainstream. It's found in many Jewish homes to this day. And I think I'm going to leave you, Nachi, with one anecdote, which is in my book, Post-Sabane Sabanism. It's very cute, and it bespeaks quite a bit. The Chida, that's Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai, a great Sephardic luminary who starts out in Eretz Yisrael and becomes a Shadar, one of the Shluchei Eretz Yisrael, an emissary, and he travels through North Africa and Asia and Europe, and eventually settles down in Livorno, Italy, where he was buried. I know today he's in the Har Nuchot in Givat Shaul when you come in, but he wasn't always there. He never held any rabbinic position in Livorno. It's not like he was the Mora d'Asra. Yet Italian Jewry deferred to his authority. And one of my studies, which you're probably not aware of, it was published by the late, great Eitam Henkin, is a tshuva that I got a hold of, a manuscript. The Sabadians had a custom to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah at Hanetzach Hama. And one of the rabbis of Italy goes back and forth with the Chidah. And this rabbi defends the custom. And it's a very lengthy teshuvah and full of melitzot. And I had a wonderful time unpacking all of the flowery language that these rabbis would write in. And it was a widespread minhag in the Sephardic world to blow shofar Rosh Hashanah. You wanted minhagim, so I'm giving you a minhag. It's not in post-Sabbatianism. It was published in this journal edited by Eitam Henkin, who, as you know, was he and his wife were murdered, Chol HaMoed Sukkot, I think it was 2015, if I'm not mistaken, a great scholar. And I gave him this essay of mine, and he published it, he edited it, he cut it down. But I'll forgive him for that, especially as a kaddosh. So he felt it was too long, so he had to whittle it down. Some of it was lost. But the man who was responsible for being mevatel this minhag, single-handedly disappeared this minhag, was the Chidah. And as I said, while he held no official rabbinic position, he wasn't a rav, he wasn't a dayan, but Italian Jewry deferred to the authority of the Chidah. And that was the end of the minhag. And nobody is doing it today that I know of, blowing shofar. And they said, come on, unless you, Nachi, want to revive this minhag in Lakewood, you'll set up a shtibel there where they'll blow shofar at Hanetzach Hama. There were minhagim of the Sabbadians, and I record some of them in my book. And there was a literature, most of it was disappeared by the Rabbanim. They did not want to know from this Sabbadian Kabbalah. Today, this Lior Holzer of Holzer Sfarim Yerushalayim has published Nathan of Gaza's magnum opus, Sefer Bria. Any Jew can buy it, and you can get a sense of what his Kabbalah is all about. But the one book that miraculously survived all the onslaught of Rav Yaakov Emden, and it's amazing, is this Chemdat HaYamim. And so the story, I promised to leave you with an anecdote. Living in Italy, Livorno is the Chidah. And there comes to Livorno an Ashkenazic shaliach. And he badmouths the Chidah. He writes a letter back to the German Rabbonim that, lo and behold, Chaim Yosef David Azulai of Livorno has this book, Chemdat Yamim, in his possession. And he studies it, and he venerates it, and he teaches from it. Now, it just so happens that this Ashkenazic shaliach had a very sordid reputation. without going into details, I'll leave it to your imagination. He was guilty of sexual improprieties, we'll call it, okay? So the Chidah's response, he wrote a letter defending himself to the rabbis of Germany. He said, your friend, this Ashkenazic shaliach, he accused me of Chemdat Yamim, but he's guilty of Chemdat Leilot.
So that's a very interesting story, especially the Chidah now is like not the word, is appropriate in the news. Now, there's been two brand new editions of Magal Tov, just of his travelogue been published. So one from Machon Amora, a complete one, and one is only the first volume, but with that beautiful color pictures and comments. So just mentioning the Chida, obviously Machon Amora is working on Kol Kisvei Chida, many of his stuff from manuscripts. I thought you mentioned the Chida. A couple of things to mention. First of all, I had Rabbi Chil Goldhaber on the podcast for listeners who listened or may have not listened to go listen to that about the Chemdas Yomim, and he discusses about that. He picks up with Tishbi's theory, throughout Rebbe Ghazi being the author. And then also about Nathan of Gaza, you mentioned. So I talked and made a lot of comments, discussed that with Avinoam Stillman in an earlier episode. People can listen as well. And I mean, so first of all, also, I still didn't mention the post-debating Sabbatianism and Caught in the Crack. I'll put links. They're available on your website on oroth.com. I'll put links in the show's notes that people can check it out. I'm going to put those links up. Everyone can purchase them. And the post-debating Sabbatianism is kind of, you know, Vitaly gave kind of a flavor of what it's about, going through various, you know, Talmid Chachamim, Mechavrim, and their Svarim, and what it's, things that from there that are Sabbatian or not, either Yaakov Emden mentioned or others, and, you know, you point out. And, you know, you're not saying, I don't speak for you, but you're not saying necessarily that apostles, you know, this goes to that whole broader question, that does it pass the whole thing or not? Yaakov Emden would say yes, but otherwise not. There's certain things that are Sabbatian or are not. In these books, and what does that mean that one was especially a post-Sabbatian Sabbatianism, Sabbatian. Another, there are a couple of appendixes in the book. I want to mention that one is fascinating, halachic decision of Shabbosai Tzvi. This is a Knesset Gdola about using Yayin and Matzah, I think. And Cardozo says that it was, that the Knesset Gdola quotes Chatzor v'Mirabanon, and Cardozo says this was Shabbosai Tzvi. He was being Machmer, I think, in the Knesset Gdola was Megel. And it seems like Meir Benio takes it at face value, believes that was the case. But you can check this out in the appendix. And there's a couple of other appendixes as well. So, yeah, and with that, I want to thank you, Vital, for joining me. And hopefully, you know, people can check out these books and if they want to read more about this.
Yeah, they're available at the Oroth website, oroth.com.
Okay, I'll put the link in the show's notes.
Well, thank you very much, Nachi.